This is Traces of Reality. I am Guillermo Jimenez. My guest today is none other than Mr. James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. Thank you very much for joining me today, James.
Well, it's really great appreciate to be here. It. Thank you so much for having me on.
Absolutely. And, you know, right off the bat, something I wanted to say, first of all, is that, you know, I visited your website and I've been, you know, reviewing and following your work for some time now. And I got to say, I am a fan of what you do. I've been very impressed, not just with the quality of your work, but also the quantity of it. I know for a while you were doing a radio show with Republic Broadcasting Network, which is the network that I just recently joined myself. I understand that show is now on hold for personal reasons, but you also do a daily podcast. You do multiple videos on YouTube a week. You've got your weekly collaboration with Media Monarchy. You've got the column and video reports for Sybil Edmonds at Boiling Frogs Post. And now you're working with Gary Franchi for the Next News Network. Yeah.
It sounds pretty impressive when you put it all together like that. And I took over from Bob Chapman for the International Forecaster. So
there you go. Exactly.
Definitely full.
I knew I was leaving some stuff out. So, I mean, my first question to you, and at the risk of being a little too vague, was just how do you do it? You know, how do you do it all?
Good question. Not having much of a life outside of this helps. yeah. I suppose it has been greatly helped along by the fact that I now do this full time. So obviously for the first few years of the website, I was teaching English here in Japan on the side and doing all of this work kind of when I came home at night. And that led to a lot of sleepless nights. But obviously since I've been able to go full time, I can just commit myself more to this. But basically, I mean, this is what I want to do, so it's not exactly a chore for me. The only thing that I kick myself about is that I can't do more, and I always have many more ideas than I can possibly actually physically do, although I try to do as many of them as I can, which is not always the best idea. So I'm still, for example, working on this book that I've been promising my listeners for 3 years now, over 3 years, actually. So I'm going to bring it out anytime now. But yes, I mean, it's too much to possibly do. And there's never a time when I could say, oh, well, I think I've done enough. I mean, there's always so much more that needs to be done. And I'm glad to see that there are so many people like yourself that are taking up the mantle and starting their own programs and helping along with this, because many hands make lighter work at any rate.
Right. No, I know exactly what you mean. I just started doing this about a year ago when I started doing alternative media writing for a local alternative newspaper here locally. And then I started the podcast maybe 6 months ago. And then the live show with RB and maybe just a few weeks ago now. And so I know exactly what you mean. I mean, I struggle to find the time to do what I do. So again, it seems so impressive that you've been able to accomplish so much with the time that you've had. You've been at this for now, I think, 6 or 7 years. Is that right?
This is my sixth year. That's right.
Right. So again, yeah, I think that is really impressive, and I know exactly what you mean about not having enough time to do everything that you'd like to do. Again, I just recently started doing this full time myself. Like I said, I was a teacher as well. I taught American history, and that's something that I want to ask you about, because I know that's a subject that you've touched on in your reports and your writing about the current state of public education. Since I have my own experiences with it in the public education racket, I learned firsthand what it's all about, and so again, I was just wondering, you know, your take on the current state of public education as it stands.
Well, I suppose my direct experience is with the Japanese public education system, so there's going to be those differences. But I generally speaking, I mean, it looks somewhat similar from country to country, and certainly it has been standardized over the course of the last century, because a lot of people are following the same template, which originally grew out of Prussia from the late 19th century. And that was a template that was exported around the globe and was adopted quite vigorously and enthusiastically by the robber barons of the late 19th century there in the United States, who pushed this as the model and template for what should become the United States public school system, because, and specifically and admittedly and on the record, because it turned out, or it was expected to turn out, better workers for the industrial process, and
exactly.
Basically just getting children to conform to the types of things that they would see in their regular industrial workday, and getting them ready for that kind of lifestyle, to be trained to stop and start on command with bells and whistles.
Exactly.
And being told what to do by authority figures. So it was something that was very much pushed. But interestingly enough, although it is pretty much accepted and almost universalized at this point, so that people can't even imagine a life without this public education system, it was in fact vigorously resisted by a lot of people at the time. It took an awful lot of propaganda and a lot of compulsory education laws and the like to force it down people's throats, until they got to the point where now everyone just thinks it's a standard thing to do.
Yeah, and just again, through my experience, I've seen that it is getting worse and worse as the years progress. I know several educators that I worked with who had been doing it for some time, for maybe 30, 40 years now, just, you know, have nothing positive to say about the current state of education. Just in their short, you know, careers, with long careers compared to what I had with education. But in their time with it, they saw it get progressively worse, more and more standardized, more and more centralized, more and more federalized, less control coming from the local school districts and communities onto states, and now to the federal government, of course, now with No Child Left Behind. And you know, children, I think, now in public education are treated more as inventory than they are as students. And that's what they care most about, is are they attending school? Are we going to get those federal dollars for their attendance? And that's really what it boils down to. It's become a business more than a way to enhance the thinking or learning in any way.
Unfortunately so, but because it's a monopolized business that is state-enforced, mm-hmm. it is one of those businesses where the more it fails, the more that they can actually expand it and expand what they're doing and take more of your tax money in the name of saving the system. So it's right. That horrible self-feeding vicious circle where the worse it gets, the bigger it gets. And it's just going, starting to disappear down that black hole.
Yeah. What would you say are some of the possible, I guess, solutions to try and reach a younger audience, say, you know, school-aged children, for example, that are, you know, being indoctrinated through these government education programs? How do we reach that type of audience? Or how, not us necessarily, but just parents in general, give their children a quality education when they've gone through so many years of indoctrination through these government schools?
Well, it's an important question, and I'm glad that more people are at least thinking and talking about this now. I think that has to be part of the solution in and of itself, is starting the societal conversation about this, right, so that people understand what's at stake. But I think, just looking back at my own schooling, which took place a couple of decades ago now, and thinking about what's happening now, I think the fundamental difference has to be what's happening on the internet, which obviously didn't exist, or it existed, but no one knew about it when I was when I was going through school. So I think that has to be part of what we would look at in a more up-to-date 21st century model of what education could potentially be. And I just looking back at my own schooling, it's interesting to me to think about the ways that I was indoctrinated without ever expecting that or understanding what was going on. But I came out of that Canadian public school system where I grew up, as exactly like so many other Canadian public school students, come out as a good, in Canada, basically socialist, who toes the sort of Canadian political party line and doesn't question anything, and was, of course, buying all of the green rhetoric that people are expected to buy these days, etc. I never really stopped to question any of the assumptions that were being fed into me through all of the indoctrination, and sometimes very subtle indoctrination that comes through that public schooling system. But I think the fundamental difference has to be that now there is just such a wealth of discourse that's available and at our fingertips online, from programs on RBN to all sorts of other information that is instantly accessible by everyone who has an internet connection. So it is this incredible wealth of information. And I think there's a great opportunity for parents, even if their child is a student in that public schooling system, to at least use this type of technology to broaden the scope of the things that these children are being forced to learn every day, and to get them to find other viewpoints. And I think there is a real possibility right now for a type of education that really would have been almost literally impossible just a couple of decades ago, that involves viewpoints from all over the spectrum, from all around the globe, and interaction on that level, that if there were people who were truly interested in putting together some sort of, you know, education that, that doesn't look like public schooling, but can take place online in some sense, I think there is that opportunity there. And I think that that might be something that going forward, there might be more, more hopeful signs coming out from, of people actually trying to put together some sort of educational, not curriculum, but at least a platform for learning, I guess, because it really is more, I think, about the ways that we access the information rather than the information itself, because I think mm-hmm. education fundamentally has to come down to the ways that we learn how to learn about our world, because yeah. the information itself is something that we can look up. It's instantly accessible, but how do you look it up? How do you vet that information? What do you do with it once you have it? I think those are the important things that education has to really solve, has to put those pieces into place, or at least allow the child to put those pieces into place, and which is signally failing to do in the public education system.
Yeah, I think you're right. You brought up an interesting point, because it's not just the curriculum, as you mentioned. It's systematic. It's the entire system that indoctrinates young kids to behave in certain ways, and not just, again, not just the way they think, but the way they behave. What you mentioned, the bell system, and that's coming out of the factory work and learning to become efficient, obedient workers. And I think that in itself is pretty dangerous in a way, and I think it's we don't often stop to think about that. We education as a dialogue, as a conversation, usually takes place. Well, you know, what are they learning? What's the curriculum like? Are they meeting the certain standards? But we don't bother to think of the ways that they're being indoctrinated in other ways, other more subtle ways in their behavior. With something as subtle as a dress code, for example. George Carlin said it best, I think. I'm going to butcher the line, but you know, not only do we want all these kids to think alike, we want them all to look alike too. And I think that says a lot about what happens in public school. And you survived it, and I survived it, but many people don't. And they grow up as adults with that same mind frame of obeying authority, never question an authority figure, never question your government, certainly. Your government's always right, and the perspective that they share is one that should be respected and admired and at times even worshipped. It's kind of... it's a sort of vicious cycle that takes place. But I think you're right. The internet, I think, is the leveling the playing field. Having all that information available, at least, it provides them with the opportunity to get the information, even if they are going through the indoctrination through their behavioral aspects of that. And speaking of the internet, that's something else that I wanted to ask you about. Another topic of conversation that I know you've been having recently. I think I heard your interview on Breaking the Set with Abby Barton. And I think you spoke of this maybe briefly also on Dangerous Conversations. And I'm really curious about this myself, is what you think about the current state of alternative media and what the goals are as far as spreading the information, but beyond that, what do you see coming out of this alternative media movement?
It's that's an awfully big topic. I don't necessarily want to look at this as a process with an end goal, because that perhaps it is valuable to look at the end goal, and hopefully, obviously, we can establish some sort of better way of organizing, or not even organizing our society, but just simply relating to each other as human beings that will come through mm-hmm. this type of access to information that we have online. But rather than a goal-oriented process, I think it's important just to establish the process itself, which is, I'd like to think of the Corbett Report perhaps as an example for people to follow of how to look at information, how to find information, how to put those pieces of information together, rather than simply telling people what is or what isn't true. I think people can come to their own decisions on that, but I hope that I can at least provide an example of the type of process that I go through when I look at a subject, and here are the sources that I used, and here's the way I put it together. Now you go out there and do your own research. I hope that type of process-based example setting, as it were, would become more of a norm than simply people who are supposed to be gods of some sort coming down from on high to tell us what to think and how to think. So I think there is the possibility for the alternative media to do that. But again, I think the alternative media shouldn't necessarily or can't necessarily be defined as some monolithic entity. other than the fact that it is not the establishment media. I mean, this isn't being paid for by Rupert Murdoch or any of those characters. So therefore, it is alternative media, I guess.
Right.
That would be the broad definition. But that's the only thing that really unites a lot of this. And perhaps that's a good thing, because as I've said a number of times now, what we are fighting is centralized methods of control. So I think the best way to do that is simply to be a decentralized, independent movement of people who are individuals. And they don't necessarily have to be working towards the same goals. They don't have to be thinking the same things or talking about the same things or believing the same things or saying them in the same way. Even if you do believe the same thing, perhaps you have a completely different way of putting that forward to the audience. And I'm not here to say that that's any better or worse or should be followed or shouldn't be followed. All I'm saying is that everyone out there has their own styles and ideas. And I think everyone has something to contribute. And that, to me, is the beauty of the alternative media, if we want to call it that, is the fact that it really is everyone. Everyone has a part to play in this conversation. And even if it's just through social media or even simply just talking to friends, I mean, I think that, in a significant sense, is the alternative media. It is people relating information to others on whatever basis, technological or otherwise, that goes beyond the terms of the gatekeeping that happens in the establishment media. So I like to look at it as a very, very broad rubric of things that encompasses this wide array of processes and individuals. And that's the only thing that I think really unites this alternative media. And I'm comfortable with that. I don't think there has to be a central authority dictating what should or shouldn't happen in alternative media, right? So that, to me, is the hope of what's happening right now.
Yeah, and that's an interesting point also. I think that's good to think about, that anyone could be media. I mean, you're media, I'm media, anyone in this day and age with new media, with social media, it's become quite easy to take an active part in media and disseminating information. And just like you said, just telling your friends or family about what's going on with the world, that in itself is very powerful and very important. I think you're absolutely right. Something that I'm curious about is what motivated you to sort of do what you do now, to kind of take that leap and say, okay, I know how to be a little more discerning with the way I receive information. I've got a pretty good handle on how the process and by which I can receive and parse out information. What motivated you to be one to then turn that around and share it with others?
I don't know if it was a motivation in particular so much as a compulsion. I don't think there was any way for me to avoid doing this, because I realized just how important the information was. And I never, ever believe to this day that I'm any more special than anyone in the audience or that I have any special powers of being able to do this. In fact, explicitly, I never wanted to do this. I never thought I'd be doing this. I was never trained in this. I have no experience in this. It was really just a compulsion that I really wanted to share this information that I thought was extremely important. And the best way of doing that in this day and age is to start a website. So that's exactly what I did. And I didn't really have much of a thought process behind it or much of an idea of what specifically I wanted to accomplish with the website. I just knew I wanted to start the website, and it grew from there. So I'm, in my personal life, I'm not a particularly spontaneous person in a lot of ways, but this was very much a spontaneous thing that happened. And as I say, it was more like a compulsion. And I think sometimes the best things in life come from that motivation, that urge, which is simply, well, just go out there and do it. And don't think about it too much. Don't overthink it. Don't try to make everything perfect. Just go out there and do it. And it will come eventually.
I mean,
in some way or another. I never would have predicted that I'd end up here now doing this at full time. I mean, it's just beyond my wildest imagination. But life takes you in strange ways, and all you have to do is act, and things will start to happen.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean by that. That compulsion to do something. You know, whether it's in media or some other way to kind of get important information out. I know that for me, probably about 8 years ago is when I had sort of my own sort of wake up moment. And that was, of course, as a result of 9/11 and everything that surrounded that. And I think it was, you know, I must have downloaded a documentary, thinking back, it was probably the first one I probably saw was Alex Jones's Road to Tyranny. I think that's the first one I ever watched. And after that, you know, it just sort of had a significant impact on my perception. And as a result, my reality, just the world just didn't seem the same anymore after that. And so, in my own life, I sort of sought to pass that along, burn copies, little things like that to kind of spread the information out to people that you know and you care about. And then slowly, that compulsion is what drove me to kind of, there's probably more than I can be doing. I know there's something else I can do. Let me start a website, a blog. And then from there, it sort of evolved into what it is now. And so I think I understand what you mean by having that compulsion just to share the information and, come what may. Hopefully people see it. If they don't, then, I'm doing it because I feel it's important. And if an audience comes along for the ride, then so be it, even better. So I completely understand. I'm curious what your wake up moment was like. I'm willing to guess it was probably related to 9/11 with so many of our generation experiencing that and realizing the lie that it was, or just being able to see through the nonsense of the official story is what woke a lot of people up, I think, this last generation.
It certainly was for me, too. 9/11 was kind of the gateway into this. I had, of course, I knew about things like the JFK assassination, and it couldn't have possibly been a lone nut, that kind of thing.
Right.
But those were kind of isolated pieces of history that I knew about that I didn't really have any way of connecting into any sort of narrative thread. But it was actually about 5 years after 9/11, sometime around the fifth anniversary, that I started to find all of these related videos on YouTube about 9/11 truth. And it was through following some of those and finding some information and vetting it online and finding out there was some truth to some of these things that were being said.
Man.
That I never heard about from any other source, even after having read the 9/11 Commission report when it came out, because of a glowing review it received in the Los Angeles Times or something that was reprinted here in Japan. So I thought, oh, I'll go read that. So I read it and I thought, oh, that was very thorough, very well documented, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
So I bought hook, line, and sinker into 9/11. And I was one of those people who thought, oh, you can't raise questions about 9/11. That's insensitive, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And so when I actually started to do that myself and I saw the jarring discrepancy between what we're being told and what we can actually prove for ourselves, that was what really started to get me along this path. And then it was things like the Money Masters, documentaries like that, mm-hmm. that started to put some of the other pieces of the puzzle in place that made me realize that there could be a very, very, very different economic and political reality than what we've been told. And just through the mere suppression of history that once was a vital part of American history and world history, this fight against central banks and all of this that we never, ever learn anything about in, or at least I didn't in my public education.
Right.
And so it was things like that that started me along the path. The Century of the Self was a documentary I saw early on that had a big effect on me, an Adam Curtis BBC documentary. And Road to Tyranny was one of the early documentaries I remember seeing that really did change my perception. And certainly the OKC information in there was
exactly
stuff that I had never seen before. So right. It really started me along that path as well. So a lot of early influences there. Aaron Russo's Freedom to Fascism was another excellent
documentary.
So. So that was really about 2006, late 2006 is when I started to encounter all this. And it was mid 2007 I started the Corbett Report.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if you had the same experience I did, but I remember after having seen one, I just went on the sort of, downloading rampage where I spent many days, many sleepless nights watching as much as I could possibly gather every documentary I can get my hands on. I watched it, shared it. And I still remember that whole experience of just, and it's maybe a bit cliche to call it a wake up moment. I know it's probably overused, but it genuinely felt like that way. It genuinely felt like I was, seeing things with a fresh set of eyes that I've never seen before. And everything's just started to make sense. Things that previously had not.
That must be a common theme for a lot of people who are listening, because I know a lot of people have that story, but to me, that's one of the most hopeful signs for humanity in general. And when we're mm-hmm. talking about public education or whatever it is that we have on our side a natural, innate curiosity that drives us and compels us to find out the more information about things that are interesting to us. And that's something that I think they really do try to beat out of us through public schooling and things like that. Don't be curious. Don't question authority. Don't try to look into those things, we're just going to dismiss them as conspiracy theory. Don't bother right. yourself with it. But you did, and I did, and I'm sure many other people did have that experience where when you start to find out some of this information, you want more and more and more. And it's this greedy hunger for information and knowledge that takes over. Yeah. And that, I think, is the force that really is, for example, what children naturally have. They're full of this curiosity and inquisitiveness. And that is, I think, what we have to tap into, that urge, the compulsion that people naturally have for more information, is what we have to tap into. Because when people are genuinely interested in information, which, I mean, history is fascinating when you know the real history. So when people actually mm-hmm. start to find out about that, they will naturally want it for themselves. And you don't have to force someone to sit down and listen to a lecture if it's something they really want to hear about.
Exactly.
So I think that's what we have on our side.
Yeah, I think right, fortunately, there are a lot of people that do have that thirst, that hunger for information and want to know more, want to know the truth. I'm sometimes a little bit discouraged by the fact that there are those types of people that actively resist this information, that they have it so deeply embedded in their minds that they cannot question anything the government says, that when they are presented with an alternative theory, they sort of outright reject it without even giving it the time of day to look into it. So there are those types of folks out there that I'm curious about their own psychology of what makes them sort of just reject it outright without even considering it. And you mentioned that key word, that key phrase that you've talked about, conspiracy theory, and that's now used in the mainstream media to sort of to outright dismiss any idea or counter explanation. They just throw out that buzzword, conspiracy theory. And it's immediately, I've lost the word I was looking for. But you know what I mean. I mean, you completely shredded this with that video you made on 9/11, a conspiracy theory that's gotten I don't know how many views it's got now, but that was excellent, by the way. I really, really thoroughly enjoyed that. I think you really did a good job of explaining how ridiculous it is to call first of all, how ridiculous the official story is, and how that in itself is a conspiracy theory, sort of reclaiming that word again, and not having it tainted by all these negative connotations.
Yeah, I'm still interested in some of the conversations that take place around that video. And I saw when it got posted to the front page of Reddit, there were some commenters on there that were complaining because they thought this was going to be about the conspiracy theories about 9/11. But no, this is about the actual story of 9/11. And they didn't quite clue into them what was going on there. But it's funny to see people's reaction to that. But it is such a charged and such a loaded phrase that we've just sort of internalized now. It's been in the vernacular for decades now, so now people just know how to it is that doublethink process that Orwell wrote about, where people can just take a piece of information and put that label on it and completely dismiss it from their minds. And it's interesting to watch people do that. But Tragedy and Hope just recently tweeted out a CIA document that I believe I mentioned on my episode 50 of my podcast, where I talked about the conspiracy theory word. But it's the CIA memo where, in the wake of the Warren Commission report, which the vast majority of the public, even at the time, was rejecting and calling a cover-up, the CIA issued a memo to their media assets through Operation Mockingbird that used that phrase. And one of the earliest uses of that phrase, at least in that context, these are conspiracy theories, and here is how we will counter the conspiracy theorists. And ever since they started to use that phrase in that memo in the 1960s, it's entered the vernacular, specifically in relation to JFK, and then throughout the decades into any part of established history that they don't want people to go into. And it's interesting to see. I mean, once something like Watergate comes out, or Iran-Contra, or whatever the scandal might be, suddenly that's history. That happened. And yes, those types of things happened. But you're talking about conspiracy theory. And the difference is, of course, as they love to say, well, it would have, any scandal of any significance has come out. I mean, Watergate came out and Iran-Contra came out. The only problem with that being that it logically, if you actually stop to think about it, that's an unfalsifiable hypothesis, because if there are scandals that haven't come out, we don't know about them. So we can't point to them as counterexamples. So again, it just falls apart on every level. But of course, it isn't about logical or rational thinking. It is about rhetorical ways of trying to cover up inconvenient truths, to borrow a unfortunate
right.
phrase.
And you know, that is something that's really interesting to me. It's really fascinating, the use of language and how the use of euphemistic language in politics and in media. Something else that I've noticed recently in the public sort of narrative in media, not just the use of the word conspiracy theory, but now they're throwing out this phrase, and it's nothing new, but they're abusing it more and more. There's this far right anti-government fringe that they keep referring to lately in relation to the gun control debate. I don't know if you caught the Rachel Maddow piece that she did just maybe a week ago. I played the clip on the last show I did with RBN because I wanted to illustrate, you know, she uses the phrase about four times in the piece, and she invokes Waco at the beginning, Ruby Ridge to start off with, then Waco, then speaks on Oklahoma City, and the whole piece is just a way for her to frame the sort of gun debate around. You know, there are those sane ones, those sane among us that believe in gun control and believe in disarming the population. And then there's those anti-government, far-right, extremist fringe types that believe in the right to bear arms. And I see that really coming to a head. It's especially this last maybe 2-3 weeks now with so many interviews now on Piers Morgan and the like, you know, so many explosive interviews. And it's really starting to come to a head. This at least the dialogue of the prospect of tyranny being a very real one, and the dialogue of why the Second Amendment exists to begin with is taking place, but in a larger sense, I don't know if it's all that positive of a conversation the way it's being framed right now currently in the mainstream media. Did you happen to catch that piece, or what are your thoughts of use of language in general by people like this?
Right, I didn't catch that piece specifically, but I have no doubt that that type of tactic is being employed by Maddow and many others in that establishment media, and it doesn't surprise me in the least. I would posit a hypothesis on this, which is to say that anyone who counters any of these narratives from the right side of the phony left-right spectrum will be called anti-government, far-right conspiracy theorists. And vice versa, if it's on the left side, they're far left anti-government conspiracy theorists. So back in the Bush administration, of course, anyone who talked about 9/11 was a fringe anti-government left-wing nut. So it is an interchangeable term. And let's just test this hypothesis. I'm going to go out there and make a bold prediction that when the Republicans come in 4 years from now, as they inevitably will, into the White House, there will be the exact same rhetoric being employed against people who are against the Republican government in power, and instead of anti-government right-wing conspiracy theorists, they will be called anti-government left-wing conspiracy theorists. So that's my prediction. We'll test that, and 4 years from now, have me back on the program, and we'll see if that comes to fruition. But it just goes to show that this is just interchangeable rhetoric to put down anyone who's questioning whatever the official narrative coming from the White House is supposed to be. So, of course, now that the agenda is gun control, they're going to harken back to Ruby Ridge and Waco and OKC and all of those things that fed the Clinton administration back in the day, and they're starting to develop their own narratives for that now.
Right. You know, something else that I wanted to ask you about, that you wrote a piece recently, I think it came out today or yesterday, about the Zionist Organization of America. And I got to be honest, I had never heard of them before. And this is the first time I actually read about them. Of course, we all know AIPAC and their influence. But this is the first time I read about ZAO, the organization there. And I think you wrote about it in relation to the Chuck Hagel nomination for Secretary of Defense. Wondering if you want to just talk a bit about that piece maybe broadly what's going on with in foreign policy as it relates to domestic policy.
Right. Well, to put that into context, I'm doing a series of reports for the Eye Opener and Boiling Frogs Post right now, where I'm looking at organizations of influence, secret societies, or whatever people want to call them, that that have a disproportionate influence over U.S. government policy, international foreign policy, etc. And I think everyone knows about the Bilderberg. Everyone knows about CFR. Everyone knows about trilateral. When I say everyone, of course, I mean people who follow the alternative media. So there's still always work to be done telling people about that don't know about it. But for the people who do know and have been following this for years, as I have, I've heard about the Bilderberg and the CFR and the trilaterals for years and years and years and years. I have almost never heard about the Royal Institute for International Affairs, the Zionist Organization of America, the Canadian Council of Chief Executives, Common Purpose, some of these lesser known organizations of influence. So that's what I'm doing right now. I'm exploring some of these groups and trying to shed some more light on them. So again, as you say, everyone's heard of AIPAC and knows that their incredible influence in Washington over Washington's foreign policy. But there are other Israel lobbies that have in the past certainly been even stronger than what AIPAC is. And one of those was the Zionist Organization of America, founded in 1897. So it is, in fact, the oldest Israel lobby in the U.S., of course, before Israel was even Israel. And, of course, from their inception, they were fomenting for the creation of Israel. And once that was achieved in 1948, they kind of shifted their purpose into more lobbying for Israel policy, Israel-friendly policies in Washington. And so it certainly in decades past, it was a greater membership and it had more influence. It sort of waned in power and influence in recent years. And part of that is, in fact, because right now they have had their tax-exempt charity status revoked by the IRS because they did not file tax returns since 2008. And of course, the reason they did that is because in 2008, some of the requirements for tax-exempt status changed so that it required much more detailed tax forms to be filed. And the ZOA, for some reason, has been reticent to file those types of forms with the detailed information about where their money is going overseas and who it's going to and how those funds are being used and appropriated. So they have not filed for a few years, so they've had their tax-exempt status revoked. And it's not clear whether or not they'll be able to get it back. But it also brings up an interesting scandal in their history that they have been asked by the Justice Department back in the 1940s and several times since then to register as a foreign agent under the Foreign Agent Registration Act of 1938. They were specifically asked by the Justice Department to do this, and they specifically did not comply. And they were never actually taken to task for it. Surprise, surprise, they basically sailed through that with impunity. So I point out things like that in this report. And again, I like to hear that feedback that people aren't even aware that this organization exists, because I think it is important that we start exploring some of these areas and don't just become that echo chamber that only talks about the things that we only talk about. So we have to look at some of these other organizations, because to my mind, Bilderberg, of course, has had incredible influence and has shaped foreign affairs for so long. But the very fact that it is now so well known, so well understood and so much talked about indicates that it probably isn't that center of power that it had been in years past when it was really literally unknown by almost everyone in the entire population. Now that it's becoming something that's more well known, I would assume that that center of power is gravitating elsewhere. And if we don't start expanding that net and start looking into some of those corners, we might never find some of those other organizations.
I think you might be right. You know, as Bilderberg has their own official website now, I think they've had it for a few years now. So that says a lot about, I think, where that power is gravitating towards now. I think there's something to be said for that, that once that veil is sort of lifted, that the power they once had, being a secretive organization, falls with it. And I think that you're probably right in thinking that there are other organizations worth our time and worth our consideration as far as investigative reporting and research and just a discussion. I think that's very, very true. And I brought up that piece you wrote also in relation to this other thing that I just read about recently, wondering your thoughts on Rand Paul and his visit to Israel just maybe, I think it was a week ago, sort of giving away his own little political aspirations there. Maybe just your opinion on Rand Paul. I know he's kind of a divisive person within, I guess, liberty circles, I guess you can call them, if I could say that. So what do you think of Rand Paul generally, and what do you think of his visit to Israel and what it says about his political aspirations?
Well, I don't think this should come as a surprise to anyone who's been objectively looking at Rand Paul and the policies he's advocated and the things he's talked about in the past. This shouldn't really come as a surprise. I've never been under any delusion that he's anything other than a neocon at heart. And we saw that from his 2010 senatorial campaign where all of the commercials and things that he was running was all about, oh, we have to be strong on against terrorism and all of this junk playing into the war on terror narrative, that people might have deluded themselves and thought, oh, he's just playing the political game so he can get into office. But to my mind, any politician that will play that game and use the war on terror narrative and all of that garbage to get into office doesn't deserve to be there in the first place. So, but then again, I've kind of left the realm of politics altogether. I'm more of an anarchist at heart these days, so I don't actually care about the fortunes of any particular political family. But it does just serve as perhaps a further wake-up reminder to people who have woken up to the system on so many other levels that, you know, still a lot of people are still buying into the narrative that some politician or political family or whatever it is will come along to save America. And I think that's a naive assumption. I think we have to grow up and start looking at the ways that we as individuals can contribute to, if not saving America or saving the world, at least saving our family, saving our loved ones, and starting to spread the awareness and information that will be the basis for communities that will survive whatever political cataclysms may come along. And that's the type of thing that breeds true independence. That means it doesn't matter what they try to shove on us, because at the end of the day, we'll be able to weather it with each other and the communities that we've built up as alternatives.
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting point. I would agree that people do need to take up the mantle themselves, so to speak, and become their own leaders and become leaders in their communities, or again, in, like you just said, in your own family. But yeah, you know, the whole Rand Paul Ron Paul stuff. I mean, I've got to admit that I was a big Ron Paul person. I sort of you know, I was actually a delegate, national delegate, for the last national convention. But in through that experience, I sort of learned myself. Maybe about 3 years ago, I sort of told myself that, you know, this whole thing is bigger than one man or one politician, and that was a difficult pill to swallow for a lot of people that were involved in the so-called Ron Paul Revolution. You know, people sort of to a fault fell into this sort of cult of personality in the same way that they fell into the cult of personality of Obama. You know, it saddened me a bit because there was so much positive energy surrounding that campaign and surrounding Ron Paul, I guess, more broadly. And, you know, it at least proved that there are several millions of people still out there that still believe in liberty in some way, and that can be motivated to take action in some way. And so that was a positive aspect of that for me. But having said that, there was that danger of putting all your eggs in that basket, so to speak, and thinking like that this man was going to be your savior, and oh, he wasn't elected, he lost. Oh shucks, I guess all hope is lost then. And that's the reaction a lot of people had. People that I know personally still feel that way to this day, and are so disappointed that Ron Paul did not get the nomination, that they want, you know, nothing to do with anything anymore, with politics or with alternative media or whatever the case might be. But you're right. We have to be careful with things like this, very careful, and not put everything behind a single man or politician, especially a politician.
Political power is the Ring of Mordor, one ring to rule them all and in the darkness find them. Yeah. It is that thing that people think, oh, well, I can grasp it, I can use it, I can put it to good use, and I'll be able to use this power in a good way. And of course, it's always, always, always corrupting on some level, even if the person himself, I still think Ron Paul is an absolutely excellent articulate spokesman for liberty and has done such incredible work on the subject, and I certainly do respect and appreciate a lot of the work he's done over the years, but at the very least we can now see that the organization that was built up around him certainly included a lot of people who weren't necessarily on the same page, and if it's about that specifically, that political movement, then people will get caught up in that and they will be led along wherever that goes, rather than having the bedrock of knowing what liberty is and trying to exude that and manifest that in our own lives rather than looking to some outside agency to provide that for us. And that's fundamentally what government is. It's the mummy or daddy state that's going to come along and take care of us and wipe our nose after us. And if we can just get the right mummy or daddy in there, then everything will be better. Well, let's stop playing into that delusion. Let's grow up politically as a species, and let's start seeing if there's better ways to organize our society than to elect some king to come along for, you know, to rule us every 4 years.
Okay. I think you're absolutely right. I think that's very important for people to think about as we move along here towards the next possible election and the next possible savior. So people need to watch out for that. Especially, I know there's still a lot of folks who are kind of, I guess, wishing that Rand Paul would be Ron Paul and still hitching their wagons to that. But hopefully they'll begin to see through that as we move along. One last thing I wanted to ask you about before we go here. We're about almost an hour in. Something that's sort of fallen out of the American media, and so therefore out of our public, you know, collective consciousness, is the issue of Fukushima. That's something that's not really talked about much in American media these days. So I'm wondering, since you are in Japan, are there any updates with what's going on with Fukushima, and what's the general feel, I guess, there in your part of the world?
Well, in fact, just in the past week, it just came out that the fish was caught near Fukushima that was tested for radiation and had 2,500 times the limits, the legal limits for seafood radiation here in Japan. So, and that's the highest that's been tested so far. So absolutely, is it still an ongoing concern? Yes, it is. And of course, the vast majority of the radiation did spill directly out into the ocean there. So it is extremely disturbing that so much of that fish is now being made available for sale on the market, and it's now appearing in Tokyo and other places. So I think there's still some very serious issues there, and of course there's the ongoing issue with, for example, Reactor 4 and the containment vessel. The building is listing, and the spent fuel pools, the spent fuel is still in there. There's still 1,300 or so fuel rods that haven't been removed yet that they're going to start removing at the end of this year. So there are still some very serious concerns about that. Of course, the media has moved on because it's a dead story. There's nothing exciting happening as far as they want to portray it anymore. And the narrative is that it was all shut. It was all in cold shutdown by last December 2011. So that was when the story kind of officially shut down in the establishment media. It is still covered to a certain extent here in Japan, but even the Japanese media is kind of moving on. And in terms of people on the street here, it's not part of regular everyday conversation. It's not something that people dwell on, at least not in this part of the country, perhaps more so in Fukushima. But in this part of the country, it is not part of the daily general discourse that you'll hear on the street or you'll hear people talking about. So out of sight, out of mind, it has pretty much been swept under the rug. And unfortunately, I imagine it's probably going to stay that way unless and until we see some sort of really catastrophic event occur, which, you know, some other type of earthquake or tsunami in that area that sends Reactor 4 toppling or something like that, would be a horrific nightmare scenario. But barring that, I think it's just going to be that slow, silent killer that's just sitting there, just continuing to release radiation, obviously, into the ocean and unfortunately make part of Japan, for all intents and purposes, if not uninhabitable, at least extremely difficult to live in.
You know, it's no surprise to me that this story's been swept under the rug in American media, but I'm a little surprised that it's been not covered as much in the Japanese media as you just mentioned, or even that folks in that part of the world don't really talk about it much. Why do you think that is? Why so hush hush on this subject?
Unfortunately, the Japanese people are under imperial conditioning, which they've been under for a very long time, and it's such a hierarchical society, and they are so much privy to the dictates of authority that, unfortunately, at this point, all it takes is for authority figures to say something is the case, and the majority of the people will at least go along with it. That doesn't necessarily mean they deep down believe it, and it doesn't mean that, for example, a lot of Japanese people aren't concerned about this, and It's just that that generally doesn't spill over into public discourse here as easily as it would in the States or other countries. That's just part of the culture here, that it's kind of put on a stone face and don't show what you really feel to the rest of the world. That's kind of the Japanese mentality. We did see a breakthrough in that last summer with the incredible crowds that were being drawn every week to the anti-nuclear rallies in Tokyo. But that kind of subsided at the end of the summer, and that conversation has moved on. So now that we have the new prime minister that was elected here just a few weeks ago, they are already pretty much backtracking on everything that the former government was saying about getting rid of nuclear power, and even that government really wasn't going to follow through with it in the first place. So I think the conversation has moved on here in Japan to a large extent. And as I say, it's still covered, but obviously not with the intensity that it once was. And it's just difficult for the media to find new angles with which to cover the same story. So unfortunately, it's just kind of the nature of what happens.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, you know, I guess we're just about out of time. But you know, before we go, I know I mentioned when we first started our conversation that you're involved in so many different things now. Do you want to just share briefly what this new project with Gary French is going to look like? What exactly you'll be doing for the Next News Network?
Well, the Next News Network is going to be airing some of my video reports. So at this point, that just means that they'll be taking some of the reports that are already up there on YouTube. There's a possibility in the future I might develop a show for them, but at this point, I just don't have physically the time to do that. So at this point, they're just taking my video reports. But yes, I hope people will check out the Next News Network, nextnewsnetwork.com. It's a new network from Gary Franchi, who is the inheritor of Aaron Russo's legacy. So he's been doing incredible work there at Restore the Republic for years now, and they're starting a new television news network. That's excellent news to hear about, and just one of the many, many websites that I'm associated with.
Right. And of course, I guess people can find all things James Corbett at CorbettReport.com. And you've got the YouTube page, all sorts of things, the Twitter on there as well. Anything else you'd like to share with the audience before we let you go?
Not really, but I will be posting this up on my website as well. So why don't you tell people where they can find you?
Excellent. Well, it'll be up on tracesofreality.com. We'll probably put it up on the YouTube channel as well. And I guess you can find it also on CorbettReport.com as well.
Excellent. Well, I'm happy to be on anytime you need to talk. So thank you so much for taking the time with me today.
Oh, awesome. I very much appreciate you taking the time to talk to me today as well. Thank you, James.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. All right. Thank you. Goodbye.